Time, mortality, and language.
One of the things that I think was just running through this entire book as I wrote it was the question of time and mortality. So just as much as time applies pressures onto the use of language that we can observe scientifically, I think that our being imprisoned by time as humans also affects the way that we live our lives. This book was written in the aftermath of the death of my brother. I basically came home after that event and began writing this book. So it is just always there under the surface and sometimes on the surface. But it was something that I think really very much affected my thinking about both love and time as they run through the book.
That's Julie Sedeve. We spend the hour talking with her about her book, Linguophile, A Life of Language Love. It weaves memoir, science, and cultural commentary to reflect on the beauty, complexity, and mystery of language. This is Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station, your favorite podcast app, or at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When Julie Sedeve went to college, she thought she wanted to be a writer. But the first day she walked into her college linguistics class, she knew she'd found her life's calling. Sedeve went on to earn a PhD in linguistics from the University of Rochester, where she did pioneering research using eye movements to study spoken language comprehension. But then, along the way, her love of written language reemerged, and she began to write for non-academic audiences. Sedeve has written about language and other subjects for such venues as Scientific American, Discover, Literary Hub, and the blog Language Log. Her first book, Memory Speaks, On Losing and Reclaiming Language and Self, was named by The Economist as one of the 5 best books on language. And now Sedeve's followed it up with Linguophile, A Life of Language Love. The book explores her profound relationship with language as a scientist, a writer, and a human being. Sedeve shares her journey from a multilingual childhood to becoming a linguist, reflecting on the complexities of multilingualism, the emotional weight of language, and its profound ties to time, identity, and human connection. In our conversation, which took place several weeks before the 2024 presidential election, Sedeve also reflected on how language shapes our social interactions and cultural divides, and even our final moments. Julie Sedeve, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Francesca. I'm really happy to be here.
This is such a wonderful book, Linguophile, A Life of Language Love. And I'd like to start off actually about asking you to read a paragraph about your love of language. You'll have to set us up a little bit. It's on page 113. Tell us the context and then read that paragraph for us.
Sure. Yeah, so this book is about my love for language, but also my love for the study of language. I spent a number of decades in the lab as a language scientist, and it was really a revelation to me to discover that there was a science of language. I had grown up always being immersed in language and languages and thinking that I would become a writer. And then I essentially stumbled on a course in linguistics. And that was the first inkling I had that you could actually study this systematically. And it revealed all kinds of things about language that were just sitting below the surface that I had been completely unaware of. At the time, the approach to linguistics was quite focused on the information structure of linguistics, what that looked like, the patterns in language that could be discovered and found. But I was really drawn to the part of linguistics that was called psycholinguistics, which is how do we use it in conversation? What's the process of understanding it, of producing it, or of learning it? And that is really burdened by its relationship to time. So one of the key aspects of language is that it has to be stretched out in linear time. We use a sentence to describe many complex relationships and entities, and we cannot produce them all simultaneously. And this introduces, I think, some of the beauties of language, but also some of its imperfections and flaws that fascinated me. So I hope we get a chance to talk about some of those as well. Okay. And when I took my first linguistics class, I compared that experience to the painting by Rembrandt of the anatomy lesson of Dr. Nicholas Tulp, where he is doing a public dissection and peeling back the skin on a body so that observers can see. And I felt that that was my experience of discovering that there was a science of language, that there were all of these things inside language that I could observe. So here we go. It was not the elegance of mathematics that stirred me. It was my love for language, not as an abstraction, but as an embodied thing. In motion, implemented in, yes, real time. I loved language the way you adore a person, in their details, in the way they've taken control of your senses. I loved how language could shape the vagueness of a human voice into something precise, how easy it was to recognize a familiar voice, not just from its timbre, but also from its habits of speech, the crisp tap of her T, a slight looseness of the S, the slant of her vowels. I loved how language constantly jolted me, how a sentence could proceed smoothly and unremarkably and then upend all rational expectations, whether through its own genius or its own clumsiness. I loved the sweaty effort of forming a sentence and the satisfaction when it flew straight and landed clean. Would Nicholas Tulp's anatomy students have been so moved by their first dissection if they had never loved any particular human body, if they had not thrilled at its grace and prowess, been stricken with anxiety at signs of its frailty, if they had not experienced the strains and pleasures of their own bodies? I wanted my study of language to stay close to my own experience of it, sweetly imprisoned as it was by time.
Well, that is so beautiful. And clearly, you are a wonderful writer. So your study of linguistics has been a door that opened into writing at a certain point.
Yes, I think there are many, many things I take from my scientific knowledge of language into my writing. But I have to say that I also had to independently cultivate the skill of writing in a non-scientific way. And that didn't come for free, and it didn't come for free as a result of having been a language scientist. That is a discipline and a practice that I think, you know, in a way, this book reflects an integration of the science of language with that other part of my love for language, which came from its aesthetic value and its beauty and, you know, very much grounded in literature.
Yes. And so you, at the end of that section of your book, you talk about your own experience of language, sweetly imprisoned by time. Start out by telling us about your own relationship to language as a child. By the age of 5, you knew 5 languages. What was that like?
Well, I had been exposed to 5 languages. I knew them very imperfectly. So I had the fortune. I know that this was a difficult period for my family in many ways, but looking back, I think it was marvelous for me to have been essentially dragged through 5 different linguistic environments. I was born in what was then Czechoslovakia, and we made our way through Europe, through Austria and Italy, and eventually landed in Montreal, Canada, where I learned French before I learned English, and then encountered English in school. So I was just constantly being put into a linguistic environment that I was unfamiliar with. And I think what this did for me is sharpen my attention to language and my memory for it. So we know that children tend to report earlier memories if their lives have had periods of fluctuation and change. And for me, it was constant change and constant language change. So I think that has sharpened my observations of language from a very young age and my interest in it.
You know, I remember having not an argument in it, but a disagreement, let's say, when my granddaughter's mother is Japanese and her father is American. And I remember having a bit of an argument with her paternal grandmother, who was a speech and language therapist, who was very insistent that it would be very bad for my granddaughter to get confused by learning Japanese and that her mother should not speak to her in Japanese. And myself, as a person who had learned Spanish along with English, I've always felt like it was such a gift to have Yes. two languages. So talk about the notions of multilingualism and how your own experience goes counter to that.
I would love to. And I'll ground that not just in my own experience, but I think in what is now understood by researchers. And, you know, this opinion was not isolated. I think it's beginning to shift somewhat, but for many, many years, teachers and so-called language experts did advise monolingualism in much of North America in the early years of life. And we now know that confusion is really not happening in the child's mind. So there are studies that show that even before birth, the child is picking up on patterns of their language that distinguish it from other languages, so that even from the first moments of life, they know that the language that they have heard while in the womb sounds different than a language that is unfamiliar to them. So they know which system they're in. You know, and this also speaks to the fixation that many people have that if you do expose your child to more than one language, you need to be consistent, that one parent has to speak one language and the other has to speak the other language all the time. And really, there's no evidence that that needs to happen because the child has so many cues from the language itself, whether we're in we're in Spanish or whether we're in English, and doesn't need that additional cue of the, you know, which parent is speaking it. So the notion of confusion is just really not one that has been upheld by closer scientific scrutiny. And of course, in my own experience of language, English being my fifth, once I started learning it in school, it very quickly came to dominate the others. And that's such a typical pattern for immigrant children, is that they might start school knowing very little of the language of the school, but within a couple of years, they catch up. So a little bit of patience on the part of the adults that are involved, but children are remarkably flexible and adaptable. And what they really need is just rich language in whatever languages are part of their lives.
Yes, and I've also seen some evidence or in scientific studies that people who are multilingual actually are smarter in some way. I mean, of course, it's hard to generalize, but that there's not only is it not a disability, but it actually adds to the capacity to understand language.
Yes, and there have been studies that shown that even kids who do have language disabilities of some sort do not seem to be disadvantaged by the learning of multiple languages. So they will still have a language disability, but they will not be more disabled by learning a second language than they would have been if they had stayed as monolinguals. So yes, and the added capacities of language, I mean, it just opens many opportunities. And there is some research to suggest that a certain amount of cognitive flexibility arises as a result of that. And also that if you know a second language, learning a third or a fourth is easier for you. There's something about keeping kind of the perceptual window to language less narrowly focused on the one language and more able to deal with multiple systems so that when a new one is introduced, there's a little bit more flexibility.
And Julia Sedevi, in Linguafile, you also talk about the issue of teaching language versus learning language organically, let's say, as a child does. So talk about the difference between the two. I've done both. I've learned two languages natively, and then much later in life, I learned to read German. I can't say that I speak it. I learned to understand some Dutch. And in high school, I learned French. I mean, we had a wonderful French teacher, and we studied it every single day. So, you know, I've learned it all those different ways. But it's so different when you were being taught in school. Talk about that difference, and then I'll follow it up with another question.
Yeah, so a way that children learn, of course, is they're just thrown into the deep end. And it's really striking that nobody needs to teach a child to form a sentence. You need a subject and a verb and an object, you know, the things that we're taught in school. And yet these things are just sucked up from the environment. In a way, some aspects of learning language are not that dissimilar from the way that an artificial intelligence learns language by exposure to patterns, and we find the patterns. So that is, you know, some component that we have in us just to notice the statistical regularities within language, and we absorb them. Of course, human language is more than just that. And that's, I think, a theme that I wanted to address in Linguafile. But in school, I think for the sake of efficiency, we want to get people kind of off the ground with as little input as possible. So rather than exposing them to a very large amount of input, we give them the shortcuts for forming the rules. I think this is not necessarily an inferior way to teach language. It's a different way. It may possibly be better suited to adult minds than child minds. There's some evidence that children are particularly able to learn in this way of just being thrown into the input and finding their way around it. So there are certain advantages to that kind of teaching formally, especially for people who want to quickly access text and be able to read. But what it does mean is that it's not as embodied. So it tends to be more removed from our senses. It's not as embedded in social relationships as learning a first language is. And this might, you know, affect the way that we have a relationship with that language. So there's very intriguing research that suggests that people often have stronger emotional memories that are linked to their childhood languages than a language that they learned later in a classroom, simply because they learned that language in the context of close family relationships or, you know, loaded social contexts. And there's an intensity there that is often missing from a second language. So it's very common, for instance, for people to feel that swear words in a second language are just not as potent as in their first language.
And I think also there is somewhat of a washing out of meaning or the salience of meaning.
Yes, a number of writers with multiple languages have written beautifully about that. One example is Eva Hoffman's Lost in Translation, where she talks about her transition from Polish to English as an adolescent and how her early experiences of English, which were learned primarily in school and with text, were just not as imbued with any sensory detail, that they had an abstraction to them that Polish words did not for her. And I would say that is my own experience. I feel that Czech for me has a particular place in terms of its emotional and sensory resonance. And that's something that I very much want to keep as part of my life.
You also make a point that teaching language in the way it is taught is something about fear is involved. You talk about the rigid order with which foreign languages are taught expresses fear of the unknown, fear of the other in some way.
Yeah, I think it, what I think it does is it imbues a sense that there is a correct way to use language in an incorrect way. You know, much like there is a correct way to solve an algebraic equation and an incorrect way. And so some of the adventurousness, I think, is maybe lost. Adults anyway are more inhibited than children when learning a language. And I think that the classroom setting often, by virtue of making an academic discipline as opposed to a social interaction that we just figure out, you know, plays into this. If you step into an environment where there's true multilingualism, I'm thinking, for example, of Montreal, a city that I really love in part because people most of the time are bilingual to some degree, but it's also true that many people don't perfectly command both English and French. They might have learned one in school and the other with their friends. And in interactions with people that you don't know, there's this negotiation of what language do we speak? We often speak a mixture of both. And if you can't find the word in one, you dip into your bag of words in the other. And there's a comfort level with that kind of imperfection of language that I really, really enjoy. So I can't recommend highly enough, you know, exposure to those kinds of environments to begin to break down some of the fear that people might have of speaking a language incorrectly.
I felt that this book, Linguophile, A Life of Language Love, Julie Sedivy, was really a philosophy of language, a philosophy of linguistics. Well, more than that, a philosophy of language. Because philosophy, I always feel philosophy is about how to live. And fundamentally, it's asking the questions, why are we here? What's this all about? So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that. Was I getting that right?
Yes, and I want to emphasize philosophy, not in the sense of a professional philosopher, because there is a very rich tradition of philosophy of language that has made its way into the scientific study of language. But absolutely, the question of how to live preoccupied me very much throughout the writing of this book. And, you know, to me, language is just so entangled with the project of being human from birth to death that I wanted to capture that aspect of it as well. You know, there is value sometimes in separating it out for the purpose of scientific study of a particular phenomenon. But here I wanted to re-embed it within human life in all of its facets. And, you know, I have to say that one of the things that I think was just running through this entire book as I wrote it was the question of time and mortality. So just as much as time applies pressures onto the use of language that we can observe scientifically, I think that our being imprisoned by time as humans also affects the way that we live our lives. This book was written in the aftermath of the death of my brother. I basically came home after that event and began writing this book. So it is just always there under the surface and sometimes on the surface. But it was something that I think really very much affected my thinking about both love and time as they run through the book.
Yes. And I'd like to get back to your brother later, but let's unpack this notion of language and time. You know, as you say in the book, the present is the only thing that actually exists, but it is the smallest part of time.
Yes.
And you've alluded to this to a certain degree, but talk a little bit more about your study of time and language and what that how that fits into this how to live.
Oh, okay. Well, this is, yes, a book-length project, but let me try to capture some of the essential pieces of that. So, yeah, absolutely. You know, the present is vanishingly small. We live in it, but it's gone immediately. And you can see this in language just in the fact that by the time I finished uttering the sentence, it's gone, it's passed. And now you're relying on your memory to retrieve what I said and to make sense of it. Given the fact that our capacities, our memory capacities have limitations, this means that there are certain pressures on time as a result. As I'm speaking, your mind is immediately trying to identify the relationships between the various elements of the sentence, even identify specific words based on just the smallest slices of pronunciation, and make predictions about where the sentence is going in the future. And this leads to some really interesting, unexpected phenomena. So, for example, it means that language is constantly ambiguous to us. Even if a sentence feels unambiguous by its end, while you were in the middle of it, you were considering many possible outcomes for individual words and sentences, and we're typically not aware of this. I found this, you know, this was one of the first things that I learned about language, and I began to study it, is the depth of ambiguity and uncertainty that is present in language. And I think this is profound and beautiful, and to me, almost a metaphor for life, that we often really seek to reduce ambiguity and uncertainty in our lives. But it is something that we're very proficient at in the domain of language. So that's just one of the interesting parallels that I tried to pull out in the book.
So I've always had this question ever since I studied German, because German has the verb at the end of the sentence.
Yes.
So this very much is relevant to talking about time. You know, so I always found it actually rather difficult because I was so aware of being in that state of uncertainty. Where is this yes. going? You know, so reading is okay because you can leap to the end of the sentence and read the verb and then you can go back to the beginning. But speaking, you can't. And when you're listening to someone talk, you can't. And of course, in English, we have the verb right up at the beginning, unless there's a dependent clause that begins the sentence. But it's pretty close to the verb, basically, generally. So how might this make Germans thinking different than English speakers?
Yeah, this has fascinated psycholinguists because it's generally languages have tricks to try to minimize pressures on memory. So, for example, if there's going to be a very long phrase that needs to unfold that we have to wait through before we discover an important relationship in the sentence, that tends to be loaded up to the end so we can figure out what the relationships are. So, for example, if you have an object, you have a sentence like, I gave the boy an apple, but now instead of the boy, I have a much longer phrase. I gave the boy who I met yesterday while riding on the train an apple. We have a trick that says, I gave an apple to the boy that I met while riding on the train. So we have this way of putting the verb in a place where now we make those relationships clear. So German is a little bit of a puzzle in its resistance to this. The fact that it is able to resist it suggests that we do have ways of mitigating some of that memory load. And the thinking is that we rely on our experience of language to do that, that we make predictions about what is coming up before it arrives, and that we're able to make those predictions based on a very large body of experience. So it's not surprising to me at all that a new learner of German who has very limited experience would find this particular feature of language of German to be especially difficult to cope with.
Right. Not to speak of declensions and conjugations and things of that kind.
Well, there's that, yes.
Julie Sedevy. Stay tuned for more of our conversation about her book, Linguafile, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Go to writersvoice.net to find more great content, including web-only features like interview transcripts and extended interviews. Let's get back to my conversation with linguist Julie Sedevy. Her book is Linguafile, A Life of Language Love. Just before the break, we were talking about how we process language and the bearing that time and memory exert on that processing. So what you're talking about here is basically processing language. What about people who have disabilities or difficulties in processing language? How does this time negotiation impact them? And what are some therapeutic ways that they're taught and how to deal with it?
Oh, I'm not sure I'm really qualified to address that. I don't know a whole lot about the therapeutic aspects of addressing those issues. But what I will say is that all of us are only temporarily abled, or, you know, are the peak of our abilities physically or cognitively occurs within a certain window of our lives, and it does decline. And one of the fascinating things to me is that it's known that aging brains, the thing that they give up very quickly is speed of processing. And that's really interesting because language is so time dependent. So you would think that losing speed of processing would make it very difficult to understand a complex sentence, for example. And the reality is that as we get older, we have surprisingly little difficulty in dealing with even complex language, that throughout most of our lives, we manage to have conversations very well, unimpeded by that loss of processing speed. So the answer there in part is exactly the same answer I gave about German, is that what insulates us is a body of experience with language that continues to accumulate over our lives. We continue to be better at making predictions about the future of a sentence based on its past that is grounded in our experience of language and specific words and what kinds of friends they tend to have and what kinds of sentence structures they tend to occur in. So I find it so reassuring that we're able to draw on our past experiences, even as some of our raw cognitive capabilities begin to decline. And the other thing I will say is that I think humans in interactions with each other are enormously flexible, and that we're very good at understanding each other's messages in ways that go beyond the language that is produced, that's a capability that we really lean on. So we understand the implications of a sentence, even if it's a very simple one that doesn't pack into it all of the things that the speaker meant to convey. Of course, this sometimes gives rise to misunderstandings as well. But for the most part, it's also an ability that insulates us from some of the fragility that's inherent in language.
Yes, you also talk about, you know, in terms of the speed of retrieval of words, and this is something, you know, I've discovered as I've gotten older, they get a little more recalcitrant. You know, I have to kind of let it lie for a few minutes, and then they'll usually float to the surface. But you point out that could be a function more of the fact that older people just have many, many more words in there than young people do. So young people may be able to retrieve a word more quickly because they have so many fewer words.
Yes, absolutely. So this is, I really enjoyed writing this chapter because to me it was a chapter about questioning the nature of loss. You know, what does it mean to call something a loss when it's a change? We go through change our entire lives, from childhood to death. And many of those changes we don't call losses, we call them growing. And this is, a beautiful example of something that has been framed as a loss, but really could be seen as a sign of growth. Connection between the size of your vocabulary and the time it takes to retrieve a word, I think, is also related to findings that when you ask experts to explain a concept, they often speak with a greater number of disfluencies than someone who knows much less about the subject. So there are more ums and false starts and backtracking. And this seems really counterintuitive because we're trained to think of these disfluencies as flaws, impediments, a sign that you are actually lacking in expertise. But what it is, again, the same phenomenon that if you have a large store of knowledge, you are having to spend more time thinking about exactly what to retrieve. Maybe you're aware that this thing that I want to convey. Well, it's not that simple, but for the purpose of this conversation, I'm going to oversimplify it. So you're making many more decisions as you speak if you have a very large body of knowledge.
I have to say I found this this part of the book especially interesting because as a radio host, through the years, I've been doing this since 2004. So the podcast has been since 2006, but the show has been on for 20 years now. And I noticed somewhere along the way that journalists have a lot of ums and ahs when they're explaining their book. And I was taught very early on to edit out the ums and ahs. And you actually even talk about that. I'm not going to do that quite so much from now on, I have to say, because you say that the ums and ahs actually help the listener to understand what's being said, as well as the speaker to speak them. So I don't know if that's my comment on that. I don't know if you want to add to that.
Yeah. And the way that they help the listener is because we tend to insert ums and ahs in front of particularly complex material. So, you know, if a word is an unusual word, we generally will take a little bit more time to find it than if it's a very common word. So that actually turns out to be a very helpful signal to the hearer that, oops, complex word coming up or a complicated phrase coming up. And it seems to do something to sharpen their attention to it. But we have this notion that speaking in public or on a podcast is a type of performance. And we have a certain aesthetic of what that performance looks like. So I find I'm so interested to hear that this might change your thinking about how much to edit those out.
Yeah, exactly. Now, I was also very interested in your chapter about differences about women and men. You talk about how women are often labeled by scholars as using tentative language, but you say that that's actually really missing the point. A tentative meaning that in some way it's more, you know, it's unassertive, it's weaker, it's less sure of itself.
Yeah, there's a very, very rich body of literature that addresses this. And the first finding from that is that the way that women speak matters in terms of how they are perceived much more than the way that men speak. Men have much more latitude in how they speak. So even very similar phenomena like uptalk or the phenomena known as vocal fry, when people descend into the very bottom of their vocal range, tends to be very perceived very differently depending on whether it's a man or a woman talking.
And uptalk, you mean the, raising the tone at the end of the sentence?
Yes. So when I utter a sentence, I raise the pitch of my voice like this. Many people interpret that as being a sign of insecurity or a sign of, I need validation from you. But in fact, it's a feature of language that we observe in natural conversations, and it's often a way of inviting the hearer to provide a response, of drawing them in. So what get coded as signs of female insecurity are often signs of a collaborative style of conversation where I am inviting you to comment or I'm checking on your understanding of what I'm saying. I'm not simply delivering a monologue to you.
And you say also that women are more successful when they ask for a salary raise if they speak less assertively, whereas for men, of course, it makes no difference.
So one study did find that, and you know there are conflicting studies. So sometimes speaking assertively is helpful to women. Sometimes speaking less assertively is helpful to women. It depends on the audience. Sometimes women perceive other women differently than men, depending on how assertively they're speaking. So my takeaway from that is that it depends tremendously on the context and what ideas people have about how women should sound in that particular situation. And again, you know, men are much given much more latitude. They seem to be a little bit freer from these kinds of expectations of how you should speak.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with linguist Julie Sedevy about her book, Linguophile. And there was one point in the book, in this chapter, where you describe, without identifying it, what I have to assume is a description of the hearing of Justice-to-be Kavanaugh in yes. front of the accusations of Christine Blasey Ford.
Yes.
And you're talking about how different people interpreted that so differently. Tell us about that, and why did you not identify that?
I didn't identify that because I think it's a scenario that plays out in many, many different situations. It's not linked to that one. That one scenario may fade from the reader's mind by the time they pick up the book, but they might recognize it in a different situation that they've encountered that has some similarities. So, you know, it speaks to the question of, how we interpret authenticity of language. So one of the additional findings about the use of disfluencies is that a conversation feels more authentic and natural if there are some disfluencies in it. It's almost like these signals that there are some vulnerabilities in us make us trust each other a little bit more. So this has been known, for instance, in the context of advertising and marketing, that people might distrust a salesman somewhat if they are too fluent because it seems like they're rehearsed or overly prepared. So sometimes we respond very positively to signs of vulnerability, and other times we take them to be signs of incompetence. And again, it's so context specific. So in this particular case, I talk about how showing emotion is seen as a vulnerability in that particular hearing, where the woman spoke in a much more controlled, measured, rational sounding fashion than the man who expressed tremendous emotion, angst and anger and all kinds of emotional responses. And do we see that as a performance in itself that's meant to manipulate our emotions? Do we see that as a sign of authenticity? Yeah, I was fascinated to see that different people had very different reactions to that. And again, it came from their sense of how we expect a person to sound in this situation, how we expect the man to sound, how we expect the woman to sound.
Right. I mean, women can't win either way. If she had been emotional, Christine Blasey would have been emotional. She would have been accused of being manipulative.
Right.
Because she was so...
Or unreliable or irrational. Yeah.
Right. And the way she spoke, then she wasn't trusted either, because if that had really happened to you, how could
yes.
you? Whereas I think if he had responded, no matter how he'd responded, well, no, I have to restate that, because when my reaction to Kavanaugh was that he was a whiny little toddler.
Yes, exactly. I observed different reactions to him as well as... So I think it really does speak to what your preconceptions are about the person who's speaking, and that how that fits in with your norms of how they should be speaking.
So in the time we have left, I want to make sure that we get more to this question of the ambiguity of language, because that is another major point in this wonderful book. Linguophile, A Life of Language Love, and we are speaking with Julie Sedivy, the author, about that book. Especially in this time, you have a list of words on page 44 in which you say, you know, the meanings that we cannot as a nation seem to agree on, like citizen, threat, person, corruption, woman. I would add the word patriotism.
Oh, absolutely.
To me, patriotism means defending the Constitution and democracy. But to supporters of Trump's MAGA cult, it means tearing the whole structure of our institutions mm-hmm. down. So I wonder if you could comment on this vast and apparently widening gulf of meaning between these two groups. And what advice might you give to people like me who are going out at this moment canvassing? The election is a couple of weeks away. Who might like to try to persuade those who are, you know, maybe leaning to the other side, or at least to attempt to?
Yeah. Oh, these are such big questions right now. You know, I think that phenomena of that divergence in language is to me just one of the biggest reminders that we learn language in social contexts and that that really colors our experience of language and even the meanings that we attribute to it. So freedom means different things to us because we use those words with different groups of people in different ways, and they accumulate different meanings. So just like, you know, your experience with a word like music might be very much grounded in the particular music that you've experienced. That word will mean something different to you than a person who has been exposed to a very different musical tradition. So I think the split between the words really reveals the extent to which our social groups have become so divergent from each other. In a way, it's a symptom of that division. As for how do you talk across the divide, I think about this a lot because actually a number of years ago, I think it was actually in 2016 or 2017, I founded a reading group here in Calgary where I live, where every month we read a book on a political topic and we meet to discuss it. And the goal here was to try to bring people from different social groups in one place so that we could begin to maybe merge our lexicons a little bit or question our own lexicon. And one of the things that I have come to believe very, very firmly is the power of curiosity, and that rather than unspooling our own idea of what freedom means, to ask each other, what does that mean to you? What do you mean by that? And that question in itself is a point of connection and establishes the beginning. And then the person will be much more likely to be open to you saying, well, I interpret that a little bit differently because I come from this background. So I have a different set of experiences that color my understanding of the word freedom. So I think that is that curiosity about each other's experiences that have led to this divergent lexicon is probably the most powerful tool that I can think of.
Oh, that's great advice. And then the other thing that you mentioned earlier was AI. And I was surprised when you said that AI learns language a bit like human infants do. It is predictive, of course. That's what they call it, a predictive language
yes.
model. But you also imply in the book that AI is a disembodied entity.
Yes.
It doesn't
yes.
have experience in the world, much less human experience. And your book very much centers around language as the lived expression of life. So what do you see as, you know, perhaps the threats to language that are embodied in AI?
Well, I think it's really important for us to understand ourselves. So I say that there are some similarities in how humans learn because, you know, what this has been actually a topic debate for many decades within psycholinguistics is to what extent can we learn language just purely from its informational structure, that is the statistical regularities. And the way that people have demonstrated that that kind of learning takes place is we basically strip away everything else, strip away a social context, strip away an embodied environment, you know, strip away aspects of meaning. And we see, aha, like even babies can learn, for example, where the boundaries of words are based solely on statistical information when we strip away all of these other aspects. So we know that some learning can happen based solely on statistics. But of course, this is not how we as humans learn and deal with language. We are embedded in our bodies and sensory environments and our social environments. So then when we put humans back in those richer situations, we can also observe that that too has a profound effect on learning and the use of language. So it's been known for some time now that children will learn sound patterns more quickly if it's in conversation with a person face-to-face than if they're simply hearing it from a loudspeaker or even seeing a video of a person speaking. So there is something about the social presence of another human being that acts as an amplifier or an accelerant of learning. And there have been a number of studies that really try to kind of get at what is the nature of that social interaction that seems to accelerate language learning. So that's what I would emphasize, is that we are like the AI models in some ways, and they're successful because, you know, we can feed massive amounts of language to them, but we humans can learn from a much smaller amount of language because of the fact that we learn within social contexts and we learn in very rich sensory environments. So my goal was to bring some of those aspects of our experiences into the foreground, because to me, I think they are, for me at least, what enriches my relationship to language and what makes me love it, I think.
And speaking of love, then let's go back to your brother. This really struck me. The last chapter of your book is titled Silence. And you begin with that by revealing that your biggest fear is to suffer a stroke.
Yes.
That would leave you aphasic. And actually, before we get to your brother, I'd like to just recount an experience with my mother as she was in her last days. She suffered exactly that kind of a stroke. And I suffered a bicycle accident that landed me in the hospital one floor above her.
At the same time?
At the same time.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And so it was a couple of days before they could, or a day, I'd say, before they could wheel me down to her. And they wheeled me to a side of her bed that had been affected by the stroke. And the very last words my mother said to me was, "I want to see you, Franca." Franca is the name she knew me by. And for me, it was so powerful because it was the double meaning of the word see. I had always felt that in some way my mother didn't see me. And the fact that the last thing she said to me was, "I want to see you," was so moving and so powerful.
Yes.
And so in your book, too, again, it was about love. It was about,
yes,
you love me enough to want to see me. And so say something about your own experience with your brother in his final days and how that the point of that story is also summed up in the word love.
Yeah, absolutely. In a way, I think I was startled by the fact that I was in my 50s and had never witnessed someone's death that close at hand. That experience was very much a very stark reminder of the ephemerality of our own lives. You know, much as a sentence comes and goes and then it just dissipates, vanishes, our lives are lived in a similar manner. But what's left are the echoes, the meanings that people around us carry forward into the future. I was thinking about that in the months and years after a couple of years since my brother has died. But to me, it was a reminder that as things shut down, you know, we're so attached to our individual identities, our sense of ourselves, and so much of that we express through language. We narrate ourselves, we explain ourselves, we understand ourselves through language. Many of us writers write in order to understand ourselves or our world better. And the time I had with my brother was very much a witnessing of what happens when that begins to dissipate, when we have to let go of that. My brother was just so laser focused on his connection to people, his connection to the goodness and beauty of the world, that it was a lesson that is what can remain even when everything else falls away. And indeed, the last word he uttered in his living life was love.
Well, and this book is a book about love and above all, a love of language. Julie Sedavy, it has just been such a privilege to talk with you. Thank you.
Oh, I've enjoyed this conversation enormously. Thank you so much for having me, Francesca.
Julie Sedavy. Find a link to an excerpt from Linguafile at writersvoice.net. Next week on Writer's Voice, we spend most of the hour talking with Native American journalist Rebecca Nagel about her book, By the Fire We Carry, The Generations-Long Fight for Justice on Native Land. It's a gripping account of the landmark 2020 Supreme Court ruling that recognized the sovereignty of tribal lands and the long and tragic history that led to it.
When I first learned about the court case, long before it went to the Supreme Court, I felt this visceral sense of justice at the possibility that the land that my ancestors had died for could be recognized as Cherokee land for the first time in over a century. And to put some context behind that, the actual court case was about the reservation of a neighboring tribe called Muscogee Nation, but there was this wide-held belief that whatever the court said about Muscogee Nation would apply to Cherokee Nation too. And my ancestors, John and Major Ridge, signed our tribe's removal treaty. And that's what established our land here in what is now Oklahoma. But that decision was really controversial. The majority of Cherokee people opposed leaving our homelands. At the time in the 1830s, the state of Georgia was harassing Cherokees on our land and basically trying to make life in our homeland so unbearable that we would agree to move. We actually won a Supreme Court decision that said Georgia couldn't do that, that it was illegal and that they had to stop. But the state and President Andrew Jackson decided to ignore the decision. After that, and after years of countless efforts to try and protect Cherokee land, my family decided that if we stayed, we wouldn't survive.
Don't miss the rest of that conversation next week on Writer's Voice. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Stay connected with Writer's Voice. Find us on YouTube, Facebook, X, and Instagram. Just search on Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.